Welcome to the MS News Today podcast. I'm your host, Jen Powell, and I also have secondary progressive multiple sclerosis. I am a columnist with MS News Today at multiplesclerosisnewstoday.com. Thank you all for listening to this podcast. Let me invite you to join our MS forums. We have over 1,000 active members discussing common themes and sharing their experience on living with multiple sclerosis. Please consider joining. You can find the link to the MS News Today forums in this episode's description. Welcome to the Multiple Sclerosis News Today podcast. I'm your host, Jen Powell. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Annie Brewster. Dr. Annie Brewster is an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and a practicing internist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. She is also a patient diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 2001. She has been collecting and sharing patient stories since 2010. In 2013, she founded Health Story Collaborative, a nonprofit organization committed to empowering patients and their loved ones, building community, strengthening patient-provider connections, and ultimately transforming healthcare through storytelling. Dr. Brewster is also the co-author of The Healing Power of Storytelling, Using Personal Narratives to Navigate Illness, Trauma, and Loss. My goodness, what an honor it is to have you here with us, Dr. Brewster. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen. And I'm really happy to be here, but only if you call me Annie.
Oh, well, that's a deal. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Annie. I want to start with you becoming a physician. Was there anything particular that led you to becoming a doctor?
Yeah, I mean, my father was a doctor. So that was a mixed thing. It made me want to do it, but it also made me not want to do it. But I was exposed very early, I think, to medicine, going on rounds with him in the hospital, and seeing firsthand the connection and the intimacy that he was able to have with patients. He was a surgeon, but even just going to the bedside to do surgical rounds, that intimacy, it really is a privilege, and you're welcomed into someone's world like that. So I saw that pretty early, and I think that really was something that seemed meaningful. And so I was interested for that reason, but then really did have sort of an ambivalent course to becoming a doctor. Like I feel like I tried my hardest not to, because I didn't want to follow in his, we have a conflictual relationship in many ways. And so really kind of didn't want to follow in his footsteps in some ways, but kept getting sort of drawn back to wanting to have that meaningful connection, to have a tool that I could use to be of service in a real way to people. And medicine just kept rearing its head. But ultimately it was, you know, after I took a very meandering course, it was time I spent in Guatemala with a physician there who just really inspired me and was doing cataract surgery in villages and really restoring people's vision. And he was amazing. And he sort of took me under his wing and showed me that it could be done in an alternative way. And so I think he was my main inspiration.
Well, it sounds like you had two mentors in a way, and it sounds like your father might have been a storyteller. He might have really understood what it was, maybe not a storyteller, but to understand how important it is to get to know your patient.
I don't know if I'm going to give him that credit.
Maybe your second mentor. I wanted to ask you where you got that insight into medicine, that medicine is more than treating a patient for the diagnosis. It's getting to know your patient and their story.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was always the stories that drew me to medicine and seeing that sort of intimate connection. And in fact, I started in psychiatry. I did 2 years of psychiatry before I switched over to internal medicine because I was really drawn to the stories. But then after, you know, all through medical school, I was sort of going back and forth between psychiatry or maybe family medicine. But I went to Harvard. They didn't have a family medicine program, but I really had this vision of knowing my patients well, knowing their families, or at least the context of their lives and their stories. And so psychiatry was where I started, but I ended up missing the whole person. I missed taking care of the body too. And so I switched back to internal medicine. And that's a whole long saga about, you know, I never quite found that holistic picture because the system of medicine is flawed. But, you know, really it was the stories that drew me and wanting to get to know people.
Well, that brings me to my next question, which what has surprised you most about the field of medicine, which maybe you hadn't known prior to getting into it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of sad things that surprised me. One being that when I started medical school, and I think most of my classmates who started medical school, I feel like we all started out with many more interests and passions and like more interesting people. And then the sort of system funnels you down and you get sort of narrower and narrower. And you have to, in a way, I guess, to learn all this medical knowledge. But I feel like in some ways the humanity is beaten out of us. And I think they're really working to counter that. I went to medical school 20 plus years ago, so I think it's better now, but I still think it's sort of a narrowing process where you get hardened to the feelings and the pain that I think you're taught, and some of it's survival. You can't feel everything with every patient because it would be, we have to take care of ourselves. But, you know, there is sort of this message of like, don't be emotional. Don't, you know, that will cloud your judgment. Don't share any of yourself. Keep boundaries. And I, you know, I believe in all of that, but I think it goes too far. I think that actually having an illness myself has made me less boundaried and more willing to offer of myself as a human being, to express emotion. So I think that surprised me that it was so narrowing and that the human side of it was like downplayed. And I think being in practice, what really surprised me is even though I went into primary care and thought I could take care of patients and know them well, and that the system really makes that impossible, that, you know, there were these 15, 20 minute visits, even for a full physical, and it was just impossible to know people. And I had way too many patients in my panel for the number of hours I was working to know them. And the system is really flawed that way. So it felt more like a factory, more about efficiency, more like a corporate enterprise. And it really is that in so many ways, which surprised me and made me sad. So I'd say I was like disillusioned a bit.
That's a great word for it. You mentioned you're a patient, and many might not know that Annie is one of us with multiple sclerosis, having been diagnosed in 2001. Tell me about that day, the day you became both patient and doctor.
Yeah, so the day that I was told that I had the diagnosis is not the day that I accepted that I had the diagnosis. I'll start there. It took me a long time, which is part what drives this work, you know, sort of recognizing that it is a process for people when they have a diagnosis to learn how to integrate that. And my course was not smooth. So I was in my internship year of training, first year of residency, so really busy. I had a two-year-old. I was getting divorced at the time. So I had a lot going on. And interestingly, was it then? I think I was just then switching from psychiatry to internal medicine. Anyway, I had a lot of things going on in my life. And I developed some symptoms like a tingling in my feet, and I ignored it for a long time, but then it sort of ascended upwards and upwards and upwards. And finally it got to my belly button and I was like, I got to deal with this. So the long and the short of it is I went to my primary, I ended up being referred to a neurologist and, you know, had a lumbar puncture, had an MRI, had one lesion on my MRI, had things in my spinal fluid that was suggestive of MS. But I had only one lesion at that time. And so I was not really ready to accept that I had multiple sclerosis. I was like, couldn't it be something else? Anyway, the doctor that I saw, who was like a very well-respected neurologist, I found this with neurologists over the years. Many of them are research bench scientists. They have their name on every paper, but they don't necessarily have the bedside manner. It's taken me a while to find someone that did. And he was just pretty, curt. I waited a long time. I had barely any time with him, and he was just right at me. You have MS, almost certainly. You should go on the medication right away. And there was no, I felt there was no trying to get to know me or where I was or what I wanted. Or, you know, at that point, you know, as I said, my marriage was falling apart, but I really wanted more kids. And I was like, I can't have a chronic illness and start a new life. And I wasn't even thinking all of that coherently. I think I was just so overwhelmed. And I feel like he didn't leave any room for like, maybe it's something else and let's see how it plays out and let's check back in. And like, you know, it was just too, like, I was hit over the head with it. Anyway, I did not necessarily handle it the best way. I went into denial. I do think denial can sometimes be okay and helps us survive. And we have to sometimes go there. But we need to not get stuck there. And I got a little bit stuck there and just didn't want to deal with it for, and I didn't see another neurologist until I had another flare after I'd had another child 5 years later. So it was percolating though. Like it was in there. I kind of knew it, but I told my family and my very closest friends, but I was very secretive about it. I felt really ashamed, which is interesting to me as someone who's, you know, taken care of patients with lots of different illnesses and would never expect them to feel ashamed, but I felt shamed. I felt like broken. I felt like it just didn't jive with my like concept of myself, which was like this invincibility complex. I'm going to pause for 1 second, tell my daughter to be quiet. 1 second. Hannah, you need to be quiet. I'm being recorded. He's not here. He's at lunch. Sorry.
No problem. We'll edit that okay. out. Don't worry.
Edit that out.
Editing so, is yeah. nice.
Yeah. I'm sorry. No, so don't. Yeah. So I had, it just, I had an invincibility complex for sure. Like I just had been someone who had never had that kind of struggle, which sounds sort of silly now, but I couldn't take it in. And so it took me a long time. And, you know, it was 5 years later until I finally, you know, said, okay, I guess I do have MS. I guess I should start taking some medicine. But I was lucky in that I had that long lull of no symptoms. And then have had, I'd say I've been lucky in that my course has been, relapsing, remitting, and I have had most of the issues that I have are pretty easy for me to deal with. So I feel very fortunate about that. I think what really struck me about the diagnosis was what it means to change, to how it shifts our identity, right? How when we get a diagnosis like that, and how do we integrate that into who we are without having it take over who we are, and without sort of glossing over it and just being like, it's all silver linings and everything's, you know, but actually feeling the hardship and the struggles in a real way, but also feeling a sense of possibility and like, how can we move forward? And I think that's really what inspired me to start doing the storytelling work, because I realized that, well, stories help me. I wanted to listen to stories from other people. I started to slowly, gradually tell my own, and I saw the power in that. And I had never thought of that as a doctor, how, you know, we give diagnoses all the time. And we sort of are trained to think that our job is to solve that problem and get to the diagnosis. And then we kind of think, oh, done, story's over. And for the patient who walks out of that office with a new diagnosis, it's just the beginning of a very, very long, potentially lifelong journey, depending on what the diagnosis is. And so I hadn't really understood that before. And I really, through my own experience with stories, came to see that storytelling could really help people in that process. And so it added to my own healing, but also made me feel like I could offer to my patients more of the kind of healing that I wanted to help people with when I went into medicine, but that I'd felt the system really makes difficult sometimes.
Well, which is such a blessing as someone with MS and have experience with physicians that box you in and then the wonderful physicians that reach out to you and ask for more than the diagnosis. I have really come to care about myself through those physicians who find out more about me and build up maybe a team of other doctors to help those other fundamental parts of me that need caring for, the psychological aspect, the shame, the stigma, the self-loathing that I felt having MS. I got diagnosed with a disease that wasn't my fault, but suddenly I felt it detracted from my being.
And what is that about? What do you think that's about? Because I had that too.
Yeah, I think that's about a stereotype that exists that for someone who strives or a powerful person, be it a man or a woman, I think it's about anything that derails us from being that person. And I do believe it's societal. I do believe that people perseverate on one vision of multiple sclerosis, which is disability.
Totally. I think that's absolutely true. It is, it's such a variable illness and people just sort of focus in on one thing. What I hated too, is that people would be like, oh, I'm so sorry. And it's not what I wanted to hear.
Now, then you get like you overcompensate and go, no, it's not that bad. And really, some days do suck, but it's hard to find that balance because I'm so sorry is one of my worst thing. I hate that. Yet people don't mean anything, but I automatically feel like I'm being pitied and it's a hard line to walk. I think that brings me to what I wanted to ask you in accepting your diagnosis and realizing the power of storytelling, which is so exceptional. You founded Health Story Collaborative, and you did that to keep the patient voice alive in healthcare and to harness that healing power of storytelling. Can you elaborate on the inception of that and just how that went?
Yeah, so I mean, it was an evolving process. I think it came from both my experience as a patient and as a provider, but I'd say more from my patient experience. But on the provider side, sort of seeing what's broken in the system and having many, many visits with patients where, you know, we were so, our agenda was so tight because of all the things you need to do in a primary care appointment. And then, you know, you're on these time constrained sessions because someone else is waiting. And then someone would like be at the door and say the thing that really they wanted to talk about, but the visit was over. And then feeling like I couldn't be there for people the way that I really wanted to. So, you know, starting to think then about that side of it and how can I make it better as a physician, but then really from my own experience of becoming a patient and really seeing that sort of identity meltdown that I went through in the process of integration. And initially, you know, found myself not feeling ready to go to a support group because I just didn't feel I could walk in. I didn't feel that I had stepped into and owned the diagnosis completely. And I was scared to go to a support group because part of me thought, what if someone's really going through a hard time and I don't know if I can handle that right now. And so I wanted to sort of have some control on my own and listen to stories. And I found myself really yearning for stories of other people navigating chronic illness. How had they done it? I couldn't find a ton at the time. That was like early 2000s, except sort of media sound bites. And I was really wanting to find a library of stories. So I'm going to start creating one for other patients with other diagnoses. And so started doing that work and sort of on a parallel track, I was more starting to tell my own story gradually to, you know, friends and family only at first. And I found in doing that myself that it was healing and integrating for me, but also in doing the work and building this library for people to listen to, I saw, yes, like in addition to the end product that's useful for listeners, I saw how powerful it was to give someone that time and that space to engage with their story, to work on them with it, to give them a forum for sharing it, the power of being witnessed in your story and receiving feedback and all that. And I saw that firsthand. And then I was lucky very soon after that to meet Jonathan Adler, who I work with at Health Story Collaborative, who is a psychologist who studies the health benefits of narrative. And he's our chief academic officer. So I sort of came at it like seeing the power of it intuitively, experientially, and then met him, and his research really underscored all of that. And initially I was a little bit sort of pushing away the research because I was sort of annoyed as a doctor. Everyone's always like, well, have you measured it? And how do you know it's valuable? You know, that kind of thing. And I was like, what do we have? We can't, first of all, not everything's measurable. And do we have to measure it to make it valuable? And like, if I were an artist, wouldn't you just let me do this without making me measure it? Anyway, I was pushing back. It was a blind spot of mine because I do think people want the data. But John's research is really amazing because it's what he would call bottom-up science. So it's grounded in people's personal experience and stories. And it's really powerful. So I learned a lot from him about sort of how we can help people tell stories that are health promoting. And we together have designed programming to help people do that and to provide a space for people to do that. And so that's sort of how it evolved. It was very personal for sure, experiential. And then just, I feel lucky to have met my research colleague who I adore. He's great.
Well, and I think some measures can be qualitative. I think some measurements can be based in humanity and not just numbers. I think there's a great deal to offer there. Have you witnessed a metamorphosis among others who have shared their stories? Have you witnessed their freedom and their ability to accept their own diagnoses?
Absolutely. And in the book, I do feature, you know, a number of different people who've been through our programming, who've worked with us, all amazing people. And there are too many to have featured everyone because they've all been amazing, but some are featured. And yes, there are many examples of how people like, you know, I won't say it's all because of the story work, but it's certainly people find that going through the process is incredibly meaningful and that it moves them to a new place. It also changes relationships because you invite guests to listen to your story and that opens a dialogue that might not have been open before. Or we've had family members share side by side their different versions of the story, which is really neat. And we also do that with patient and doctor, or patient and provider, I should say. And that, you know, opens something new. And just, we don't have that many spaces in our environment in this, you know, day and age where people can create and talk and share in this deep way. We just have to create space for it. And so giving people an opportunity to share and talk about their relationship through their stories is really powerful. And it changes that relationship going forward.
It really does. And I like hearing about how you invite multiple members of a patient's community, because our narratives, our perceptions are built on our stories, and they are true to us. They're our narratives, and somebody else, even though we know our story, their narrative, even in our household, is completely different. So to have everybody come together and talk about the story and build that storytelling is so powerful. I'm very grateful to you for building that. You mentioned your book, and I'd like to let everyone know that Annie is a co-author of The Healing Power of Storytelling. And I want to know about your book. Can you tell us and our listeners about your book and what inspired you to dig in to want to take on such a huge task of writing a book?
Well, in all honesty, I decided to take it on now because an agent found me now 3 years ago and said, will you take this on now? I always thought I would do it, but I'm in a very busy phase of my life. So I not necessarily would have done it now, but that's part of the reason that I had a partner in the book, Rachel Zimmerman, who's a healthcare journalist. And she'd been my editor when I used to write for the public radio station a lot in Boston. So we had a working relationship, and she was a great thought partner in terms of helping just get the proposal done, think through the structure of the book, and then was just an amazing editor. So I would do the writing, she would do the editing, and we worked really well together. So that helped me stay on track. you know, I of course wanted to do it because I really believe in this work, but I think having a partner helped with the timing. But the structure is really, I'd say it's kind of hybrid. It's not, I didn't want it to be all like self-help. It's really got some memoir hybrid in there because it's very much based on my story. And I felt like that's where I needed to start because that's what grounds this work. That's what it grew out of. But then it also talks a lot about the research behind storytelling and health. And so there are chapters on that. It also goes through in depth our model of how we apply that research. So there are a lot of prompts in there that can guide readers through the process themselves. And then the second half of the book is really, as I said, highlighting some of the storytellers we've worked with and their journeys.
Well, and I want to let our audience know, I read this book and the words jumped out at me. They resonated with my own story and it was powerful. There's so seldom as a book that you read and you feel like you're reading about yourself and not necessarily in exactly what you went through, but your emotional process, how you went about your journey. And all of us have a journey, and honoring that journey is crucial to our ability to accept a diagnosis. And your words are so powerful, Annie. And I've recommended your book to everybody I know. I think until we have the freedom to tell our story, how can we possibly liberate those around us to accept it?
Absolutely. Well, thank you for your kind words.
Oh, well, they're true. They're true. And would you be so kind to let our audience know how to find your book?
So there, it's available for sale on many different websites. I know Amazon, but I don't want to only promote Amazon. I think if you go, the best way to find all of them is if you go to Penguin Random House site, and I can send you that link that's direct to them, Jen, so you could post that. But they do on Penguin Random House have a specific link to many different vendors, including Amazon, but it's definitely on Amazon, but I also like to support smaller stores.
Absolutely. And I will include that on the description to this podcast. There'll be a link on how to acquire your book and go to Random House.
There's also, I think, a link on Health Story Collaborative website.
That is another thing I would like to leave because in visiting that, I think it's so interesting to know how you came about creating Health Story Collaborative and how that led to the book. I think the relationship is powerful.
Yeah. Well, the book, I mean, is very much based on sort of the story of that journey and where we are now. The other thing, though, is like our stories are continually evolving. So
yeah. They are. And
I think that's powerful for us all to realize that we're not stuck. Our stories can change and always will change.
Always. It's a continuum. And it's actually hopeful because in those times where we have that shame and the stigma, keep going. Your story is going to evolve. Your story has just begun. And every day the story changes or grows. It's kind of, I like to think of it as growing on top of each other instead of a new day. It's like you have such richness in you and that's your story. And that's, it can't be bad or good. It's yours.
Yep, absolutely. And I think, I won't get into all the research, but one of the themes that has been linked to sort of positive mental health and storytelling is the theme of agency. And for me, it's a lot about agency that, as a patient myself, realizing that my story is something I have control over, right? That John Adler, my research colleague, will say we are the narrators and the main characters in our story. And so often we think we're the main characters and we forget that we're also the narrator. So we're also telling that story. That doesn't mean we're going to say things that aren't necessarily true, but how we make meaning is up to us. And we can't control what happens to us always, but we can control how we make sense of what happens to us. And to me, I find a lot of power in that. And that our stories evolve and evolve and evolve and that we never get stuck. So
I love that. Thank you for sharing that. Annie, as we close, is there a message you would like to leave with our listeners?
Yeah, I think the most important thing I want to say is that everyone has a story to tell. And I know a lot of times people say, I don't have an interesting story. We all have an interesting story and our stories are all valuable. So that is the most important thing. Sort of related to that, I'd say, remember that if you decide to share your story and you don't have to, that it is a gift to other people and people will resonate with it. And there is value in that sharing, but it's not required. You can still go through the process without sharing, but it does connect people. And I think that community element is important. And also related, people, it's can be writing heavy, the prompts and stuff, but you don't have to be a writer or identify as a writer. And we've even done it verbally with people who don't feel like they want to write. So there are other ways to do it. So I'd say that. The other message I think is that I want people who are new to a diagnosis or struggling is just to remember that there is hope and possibility ahead of us. Even if we can't find a cure or if there'll be struggles, which inevitably there will be, there's still hope and possibility. And that's what I wanted to find when I was first diagnosed. Since storytelling and hearing from others really helped me to learn that and to believe that. And that hope can look a lot of different ways. So I think those are the main two messages I want to leave people with. Possibility and hope. Yep.
Possibility and hope. I can't think of two better messages to leave our listeners. Dr. Annie Brewster, it has been an honor. And thank you for joining us at Multiple Sclerosis News Today.
Well, Jen, it's an honor for me. So thank you so much for having me.
And thank you to our listeners at Multiple Sclerosis News Today. I'm your host of the Multiple Sclerosis Podcast, Jen Powell. Share your thoughts on this episode through social media. You can find MS News Today on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Follow us to keep updated on the latest news and to never miss new content and initiatives. Click the links in this episode's description.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to Multiple Sclerosis News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.multiplesclerosisnewstoday.com.